Martin Kearns, Alden Mattison, Richard Olbert, William Pallison, and Donald Roberton. In August 1942, after a botched American raid on a Japanese base at Macon in the Marshall Islands, 9 Marines had been mistakenly left behind. Captured by the Japanese, they had disappeared. Louis was almost certainly the first American to learn that they had been taken to Kwajalein. But other than Phil and Louis, there were no prisoners here now. Louis felt a wave of foreboding. He called to Phil. Phil's voice answered, distant and small, somewhere to the left. He was down the hall in a squalid hole like Louis's. Each man asked the other if he was okay. Both knew that this was likely the last time they would talk, but if they wished to say goodbye, neither had the chance. There was shuffling in the corridor as a guard took up his station. Louis and Phil said nothing else. Louis looked down at his body. Legs that had sprung through a 4-minute, 12-second mile over bright sand on that last morning on Kualoa were now useless. The vibrant, generous body that he had trained with such vigilance had shrunken until only the bones remained, draped in yellow skin, crawling with parasites. "All I see," he thought, "is a dead body breathing." Louis dissolved into hard, racking weeping. He muffled his sobs so the guard wouldn't hear him. Part 4. Chapter 18. A Dead Body Breathing. Something flew through the window in the door of Louis's cell and struck the floor, breaking into white bits. It was 2 pieces of hardtack, the dry biscuit that was the standard fare of sailors. A tiny cup of tea, so weak that it was little more than hot water, so small that it constituted a single swallow, was set on the sill. Phil received food also, but no water. He and Louis crawled about their cells, picking up slivers of biscuit and putting them into their mouths. A guard stood outside. There was a rustle outside Louis's cell, and a face appeared. The man greeted Louis cheerfully, in English, by name. Louis stared up at him. The man was a Kwajalein native, and he explained that the American castaways were the talk of the island. A sports fanatic, he had recognized Louis's name, which Louis had given to his captors. Prattling about track, football, and the Olympics, he paused only rarely to ask Louis questions. Once Louis got 1 or 2 words off, the native bounded back into his narrative. After a few minutes, the native glanced at his watch and said he had to leave. Louis asked him what had happened to the Marines whose names were carved into the wall. In the same chipper tone, the native replied that the Marines were dead. All of the POWs held on that island, he said, were executed. As the native walked out, the guard looked challengingly at Louis, lifted a flattened hand to his throat, and made a slashing gesture. He pointed to the names on the wall, then to Louis. That night, Louis rested his head next to the door, trying to get as far as possible from the waist hole. He had only just settled there when the door swung open and the guard grabbed him and spun him around, pushing his head against the hole. Louis resisted, but the guard became angry. Louis gave up and lay as the guard ordered. He could see that the guard wanted him to lie in this position so he could see him through the window in the door. Every few minutes, all night long, the guard peered in, making sure that Louis didn't move. The morning of the second day began. Phil and Louis lay in sweltering silence, thinking that at any moment they'd be dragged out and beheaded. The guards stalked back and forth, snarling at the captives and drawing the sides of their hands across their necks with sadistic smiles. For Louis, the digestive miseries continued. His diarrhea became explosive, and cramps doubled him over. He lay under a blanket of flies and mosquitoes, keeping his buttocks over the waist hole for as long as he could, until the guards snapped at him to move his face back to the hole. The day passed. 3 times, a single wad of rice, a little bigger than a golf ball, sailed through the door window and broke against the floor. Once or twice, a swallow of tea in a cup was left on the sill, and Louis sucked it down. Night came. Another day came and went, then another. The heat was smothering. Lice hopped over the captive's skin. Mosquitoes preyed on them in swarms so thick that when Louis snapped his fingers into a fist, then opened his hand, his entire palm was crimson. His diarrhea worsened, becoming bloody. Each day, Louis cried out for a doctor. One day, a doctor came. He leaned into the cell, looked at Louis, chuckled, and walked away. Curled up on the gravelly floor, both men felt as if their bones were wearing through their skin. Louis begged for a blanket to sit on, but was ignored. He passed the time trying to strengthen his legs, pulling himself upright and standing for a minute or two while holding the wall, then sinking down. He missed the raft. 2 sips of water a day weren't nearly enough to replace Louis's torrential fluid loss. His thirst became worse than anything he'd known on the raft. He crawled to the door and pleaded for water. The guard left, then returned with a cup. Louis, grateful, drew close to the door to take a drink. The guard threw scalding water in his face. Louis was so dehydrated that he couldn't help but keep begging. At least 4 more times the response was the same, leaving Louis's face speckled with blisters. Louis knew that dehydration might kill him, and part of him hoped it would. One day, as he lay in misery, Louis heard singing. The voices he had heard over the raft had come to him again. He looked around his cell, but the singers weren't there. Only their music was with him. He let it wash over him, finding in it a reason to hope. Eventually, the song faded away, but silently, in his mind, Louis sang it over and over to himself. He prayed intensely, ardently, hour after hour. Down the hall, Phil languished. Rats were everywhere, climbing up his waste bucket and wallowing in his urine pail, waking him at night by skittering over his face. Periodically, he was prodded outside, halted before a pan of water, and ordered to wash his face and hands. Phil dropped his face into the pan and slurped up the water. Louis often stared at the names of the Marines, wondering who they were, if they'd had wives and children, how the end had come for them. He began to think of them as his friends. One day he pulled off his belt and bent the buckle upward. In tall, block letters, he carved his name into the wall beside theirs. Louis couldn't speak to Phil, nor Phil to him, but occasionally one of them would cough or scuff the floor to let the other know that he was there. Once the guards left the cells unattended, and for the first time Phil and Louis were alone. Louis heard Phil's voice. "What's going to happen?" Louis had no answer. There was a beating of boots in the hall, and the Americans fell silent. The guards maintained a fixed state of fury at the captives, glaring at them wrathfully, making threatening gestures, shouting at them. Virtually every day they flew into rages that usually ended in Phil and Louis being bombarded with stones and lit cigarettes, spat upon and poked with sticks. Louis always knew that he was in for it when he heard a guard arriving in a stomping fit, a consequence, he hoped, of an American victory. The situation worsened when the guard had company. The guards used the captives to impress each other with their cruelty. The pretext for many of the outbursts was miscommunication. The captives and their guards came from cultures with virtually no overlap in language or custom. Louis and Phil found it almost impossible to understand what was being asked of them. Sign language was of little help, because even the culture's gestures were different. The guards, like nearly all citizens of their historically isolated nation, had probably never seen a foreigner before, and probably had no experience in communicating with a non-Japanese. When misunderstood, they often became so exasperated that they screamed at and beat the captives. For self-preservation, Louis and Phil studied everything they heard, developing small Japanese vocabularies. Kochikoi meant come here. Ohayo was a greeting, used by the occasional civil guard. Though Louis soon knew what it meant, his stock reply was no, California. Phil learned that Mizu meant water, but the knowledge got him nowhere. His cries for Mizu were ignored. When the guards weren't venting their fury at the captives, they entertained themselves by humiliating them. Every day, at gunpoint, Louis was forced to stand up and dance, staggering through the Charleston, while his guards roared with laughter. The guards made Louis whistle and sing, pelted him with fistfuls of gravel, taunted him as he crawled around his cell to pick up bits of rice, and slid long sticks through the door window so they could stab and swat him, finding his helpless contortions hilarious. Down the hall, the guards did the same to Phil. Sometimes Louis could hear Phil's voice, tiny and thin, groaning. Once, driven to his breaking point by a guard jabbing him, Louis yanked the stick from the guard's hands. He knew he might get killed for it, but under this unceasing degradation, something was happening to him. His will to live, resilient through all the trials on the raft, was beginning to fray. The crash of Green Hornet had left Louis and Phil in the most desperate physical extremity, without food, water, or shelter. But on Kwajalein, the guards sought to deprive them of something that had sustained them, even as all else had been lost. Dignity. This self-respect and sense of self-worth, the innermost armament of the soul, lies at the heart of humanness. To be deprived of it is to be dehumanized, to be cleaved from and cast below mankind. Men subjected to dehumanizing treatment experience profound wretchedness and loneliness and find that hope is almost impossible to retain. Without dignity, identity is erased. In its absence, men are defined not by themselves, but by their captors and the circumstances in which they are forced to live. One American airman, shot down and relentlessly debased by his Japanese captors, described the state of mind that his captivity created. "I was literally becoming a lesser human being." Few societies treasured dignity and feared humiliation, as did the Japanese, for whom a loss of honor could merit suicide. This is likely one of the reasons why Japanese soldiers in World War II debased their prisoners with such zeal, seeking to take from them that which was most painful and destructive to lose. On Kwajalein, Louis and Phil learned a dark truth known to the doomed in Hitler's death camps, the slaves of the American South, and 100 other generations of betrayed people. Dignity is as essential to human life as water, food, and oxygen. The stubborn retention of it, even in the face of extreme physical hardship, can hold a man's soul in his body long past the point at which the body should have surrendered it. The loss of it can carry a man off as surely as thirst, hunger, exposure, and asphyxiation, and with greater cruelty. In places like Kwajalein, degradation could be as lethal as a bullet. Louis had been on Kwajalein for about a week when his cell door was thrown open and two guards pulled him out. He flushed with fear, thinking that he was being taken to the sword. As he was hustled toward what seemed to be an officer's quarters, he passed two girls with Asian features, walking with heads down, eyes averted, as they retreated from the building. Louis was pulled into a room and stopped before a table covered with a white tablecloth, on which was arranged a selection of foods. Around it sat Japanese officers in dress uniform smoking cigarettes. Louis wasn't here to be executed. He was here to be interrogated. The officers took long draws on their cigarettes and sighed the smoke toward Louis. Periodically, one of them would open a bottle of cola, pour it into a cup, and drink it slowly, making a show of his enjoyment. The ranking officer stared coolly at his captive. "How do American soldiers satisfy their sexual appetites?" he asked. Louis replied that they don't. They rely on willpower. The officer was amused. "The Japanese military," he said, "provides women for its soldiers," an allusion to the thousands of Chinese, Korean, Indonesian, and Filipino women whom the Japanese military had kidnapped and forced into sexual slavery. Louis thought of the girls outside. The interrogators asked about Louis's plane. They knew, probably from Louis's conversation with the officers on the first atoll, that it was a B-24. What model was it? On Oahu, Louis had heard that during a battle, a B-24D had crashed on a reef and had been retrieved by the Japanese. Green Hornet had been a D model. Knowing that the Japanese already knew about this model, he decided not to lie and told them that he had been in a D. They handed him a pencil and paper and asked him to draw the plane. When he was done, his interrogators held up a photograph of a D model. They had been testing him. "What did he know about the E model B-24? "Nothing," he told them. "It was a lie. Superman, while always officially a D model, had undergone upgrades that had effectively made it an E." "Where was the radar system?" The location of the radar had no bearing on how it worked, so Louis told the truth. "How do you operate it?" Louis knew the answer, but he replied that as a bombardier he wouldn't know. The interrogators asked him to draw the radar system. Louis invented an imaginary system, making a drawing so elaborate that, it was later written, the system looked like a ruptured octopus. The interrogators nodded. They moved on to the Norden bomb site. How do you work it? You just twist two knobs, Louis said. The officers were annoyed. Louis was sent back to his cell. Suspecting that he'd be brought back, Louis brainstormed, trying to anticipate questions. He thought about which things he could divulge and which things he couldn't. For the latter, he came up with lies and practiced until he could utter them smoothly. Because he'd been partially truthful in the first session, he was now in a better position to lie. Phil was pulled in for interrogation. He, too, knew about the captured B-24D, so he spoke freely about the plane's components. The interrogators asked him to describe American war strategy. He replied that he thought they would attack the outlying captured territories, then work their way in until they defeated Japan. The interrogators responded with whoops of laughter. Phil sensed something forced. These men, he suspected, thought that Japan was going to lose. Louis was sitting in his cell when a new guard appeared at the door. Louis looked up, saw a face he didn't recognize, and felt an upswell of dread, knowing that a new guard would likely assert his authority. "You Christian?" the guard asked. Louis, whose parents had tried to raise him Catholic, hadn't gone near church since one Sunday in his boyhood, when a priest had punished him for tardiness by grabbing him by the ear and dragging him out. But though Louis emerged with a sore ear, a little religion had stuck with him. He said yes. The guard smiled. "Me Christian." The guard gave his name, which Louis would later recall with some uncertainty as Kawamura. He began babbling in English so poor that all Louis could pick out was something about Canadian missionaries and conversion. The guard slipped two pieces of hard candy into Louis's hand, then moved down the hall and gave two pieces to Phil. A friendship was born. Kawamura brought a pencil and paper and began making drawings to illustrate things he wished to talk about. Walking back and forth between the cells, he'd draw a picture of something, a car, a plane, an ice cream cone, and say and write its Japanese name. Louis and Phil would then write and say the English name. The prisoners understood almost nothing of what Kawamura said, but his goodwill needed no translation. Kawamura could do nothing to improve the physical conditions in which the captives lived, but his kindness was life-saving. When Kawamura was off guard duty, a new guard came. He launched himself at Louis, ramming a stick through the door window and into Louis's face, as if trying to put out his eyes. The next day, Kawamura saw Louis's bloody face and asked who had done it. Upon hearing the guard's name, Kawamura hardened, lifting his arm and flexing his biceps at Louis. When his shift was up, he sped away with an expression of furious determination. For 2 days, Louis saw nothing of Kawamura or the vicious guard. Then Kawamura returned, opened Louis's cell door a crack, and proudly pointed out the guard who had beaten Louis. His forehead and mouth were heavily bandaged. He never guarded the cell again. As Louis and Phil lay in their cells one day, they heard a commotion outside, the clamoring sounds of a mob. Then faces pressed into Louis's door window, shouting. Rocks started flying in. More men came, one after another, screaming, spitting on Louis, hitting him with rocks, hurling sticks like javelins. Down the hall, the men were doing the same to Phil. Louis balled himself up at the far end of the cell. On and on the procession went. There were 80, perhaps 90 men, and each one spent some 30 seconds attacking each captive. At last, the men left. Louis sat in pools of spit and jumbled rocks and sticks, bleeding. When Kawamura saw what had happened, he was livid. He explained that the attackers were a submarine crew stopping over on the island. When Louis was taken to interrogation, he complained about the attack. The officers replied that this was what he ought to expect. The interrogators wanted Louis to tell them the numbers of aircraft, ships, and personnel in Hawaii. Louis told them that the last time he'd seen Hawaii had been in May. Now it was August. He couldn't be expected to have current information. He was sent back to his cell. Some 3 weeks after his arrival on Kwajalein, Louis was again pulled from his cell. Outside, for the first time since his arrival on the island, he saw Phil. Their eyes met. It looked like this might be the end. They were taken to the interrogation building, but this time they were halted on the front porch. Phil on one end, Louis on the other. Two men in white medical coats joined them, along with four aides holding paperwork and stopwatches. Japanese began collecting below the porch to watch. Louis and Phil were ordered to lie down. The doctors pulled out two long hypodermic syringes and filled each with a murky solution. Someone said it was the milk of green coconuts, though whether or not this was true remains unknown. The doctor said that what they were about to do would be good for the prisoners. If the solution worked, as hoped, improving their condition, they were told, it would be given to Japanese troops. The doctors turned their captives' hands palm up and swabbed their arms with alcohol. The needles slid in, the plungers depressed, and the aides clicked the stopwatches. The doctors told the captives to describe their sensations. For Louis, within a few seconds, the porch started gyrating. The doctor pushed more solution into his vein, and the spinning worsened. He felt as if pins were being jabbed all over his body. Then the blood rushed from his head, the same sensation that he used to feel when Phil lifted Superman out of a dive. His skin burned, itched, and stung. The porch pitched and turned. Across the porch, Phil was experiencing the same symptoms. The doctors, speaking in sterile tones, continued to question them. Then everything blurred. Louis cried out that he was going to faint. The doctor withdrew the needle. The captives were taken back to their cells. Within 15 minutes, Louis's entire body was covered in a rash. He lay awake all night, itching and burning. Several days later, when the symptoms subsided, he and Phil were again taken to the porch and again injected, this time with more solution. Again, they rolled through vertigo and burned with rashes. After another few days, they were subjected to a third experiment, and a few days later came a fourth. In the last infusion, a full pint of the fluid was pumped into their veins. Both men survived, and as terrible as their experience had been, they were lucky. All over their captured territories, the Japanese were using at least 10,000 POWs and civilians, including infants, as test subjects for experiments in biological and chemical warfare. Thousands died. Back in his cell, Louis felt a sharp headache coming on, and was soon dizzy and baking with fever. His bones ached. Phil was going through the same ordeal. The guards summoned a doctor. Louis picked out a familiar word, dengue. The prisoners had dengue fever, a potentially fatal mosquito-borne illness that was ravaging the tropics. The doctor offered no treatment. Louis drifted into a febrile fog. Time slid by, and he felt little connection to his body. As he lay there, feet tramped outside, livid faces appeared again at the door, and Louis felt himself struck with rocks, stabbed with sticks, and slapped with wads of spit. A new crop of submariners had come. Louis floated through it, too sick to resist. The faces streamed past, and the stones and sticks cracked off his burning bones. Time passed with merciful speed, and the abuse was soon over. Louis was brought to interrogation again. The officers pushed a map of Hawaii in front of him and told him to mark where the air bases were. Louis resisted for some time, but the interrogators leaned hard on him. At last, he broke. He dropped his head and, with an expression of ashamed resignation, told them everything, the exact location of the bases, the numbers of planes. The Japanese broke into jubilant smiles. They opened up a bottle of cola and gave it to Louis, along with a biscuit and a pastry. As they celebrated, they had no idea that the bases that Louis had identified were the fake airfields he had seen when tooling around Hawaii with Phil. If the Japanese bombed there, the only planes they would hit would be made of plywood. Louis and Phil's usefulness had been exhausted. At headquarters, the officers discussed what to do with the captives. The decision was probably easy. The same Japanese officers had been responsible for killing the Marines whose names were written on Louis's cell wall. Louis and Phil would be executed. On August 24th, men gathered before Louis's cell, and once more he was dragged out. Is this it? He thought. He was tugged to the interrogation building. Expecting to learn that he was condemned to execution, he was told something else. A Japanese Navy ship was coming to Kwajalein, and he was going to be put on it and taken to a POW camp in Yokohama, Japan. At the last minute, the officers had decided not to kill him. It would be a long time before Louis learned why. Louis felt deep relief, believing that at a POW camp he would be treated under the humane rules of international law, put in contact with the Red Cross, and allowed to contact his family. Phil, too, was told that he was going to Yokohama. He was amazed and hopeful. On August 26, 1943, 42 days after arriving at Execution Island, Louis and Phil were led from their cells, stripped naked, splashed with buckets of water, allowed to dress again, and taken toward the ship that would carry them to Japan. As he walked from his cell for the last time, Louis looked back, searching for Kawamura. He couldn't find him. Chapter 19. 200 Silent Men. Louis and Phil were sitting in a holding room on the Navy ship when the door slapped open and a crowd of agitated, sloppy drunk Japanese sailors pushed in. One of them asked if Japan would win the war. "No," said Phil. A fist caught Phil in the face, then swung back and struck him again. Louis was asked who would win the war. "America." The sailors fell onto the captives, fists flying. Something connected with Louis's nose, and he felt a crunch. An officer ran in, peeled the crewmen off, and ordered them out. Louis's nose was bleeding. When he touched it, he felt a gash and a bone elbowing out sideways. In choppy English, the officer told him that the crewmen had been rifling through the captives' wallets, which had been confiscated when they came on board. In Louis's wallet, they had found a folded, stained bit of newspaper. It was the cartoon that Louis had cut from the Honolulu Advertiser many months before, depicting his service in the raid on Wake. The officer said that about half of the ship's crew had been on Wake that night, and their ship, apparently anchored offshore, had been sunk. The crewmen had regrets about attacking the captives. Later, the door opened again, and two of them lurched in, muttered apologies, draped their arms around Louis, and gave him sake. Louis and Phil were separated again, and Louis was locked in an officer's cabin. Every few days, he had strange visits from a grinning sailor who would lean into the room, say, "Thump on the head for a biscuit," rap his knuckles on Louis's head, hand him a biscuit, and amble away. Between the sailor's visits, Louis had nothing to do but sit, pinching his fingers around his nose to set the bones. Bored, he rummaged through the cabin and found a bottle of sake. He began taking furtive sips of the rice wine, little enough that its absence might not be missed. When, during a submarine alert, he panicked and drank so much that no one could fail to notice it, he decided that he might as well finish it off. In the last days of the journey, the skinny American and the fat Japanese bottle had a grand time together. After a three-week journey, including a stopover at Truk Atoll, the ship docked at Yokohama, on the eastern coast of Japan's central island, Honshu. Louis was blindfolded and led out. Solid ground came underfoot. Through a gap in his blindfold, Louis's first glimpse of Japan was the word Chevrolet stamped on a hubcap. He was standing before a car. He heard someone stomping off the ship, shouting. The men around Louis froze. The man approaching, he assumed, must be an officer. Louis felt the officer grabbing him and shoving him into the car's jump seat. As he struggled to get his legs in, the officer cracked him in the face with a flashlight. Louis felt his nose bones splay again. He thought of the sake and wondered if this man was its owner. He folded himself into the seat alongside Phil. The Chevy motored up through hilly country. After the better part of an hour, it stopped. Hands pulled Louis onto his feet and led him into an enclosed, humid space. The blindfold was untied. He was in a bathhouse, apparently in the promised POW camp. Phil was no longer with him. There was a tub before him, filled with water that carried the tart smell of disinfectant. Told to undress and get in, he stepped into the water, luxuriating in the warmth, scrubbing himself clean for the first time since he'd left Oahu. When his bath was over, he was told to dress again. A man came with clippers and shaved his head and beard. Louis was escorted out, led down a hallway, and stopped at a door. The guard told him to go in and wait for orders. Louis walked into the room. The lights were out, and he could only just make out the silhouette of a man in civilian clothing, facing away from him. Someone flipped on a light, the man turned, and Louis saw his face. It was his college friend, Jimmy Sasaki. "We meet again," Sasaki said. Louis gaped at him in astonishment. He knew nothing of Sasaki's alleged spying, and was stunned to see his friend in the service of his enemy. Sasaki looked at him warmly. He'd been prepared to see Louis, but he was disturbed by how thin he was. He made a playful crack about how ugly Louis looked bald. What followed was a strange and stilted conversation. Sasaki asked a few questions about Louis's odyssey, then began reminiscing about USC, meals at the student union, 10-cent movies on campus. Louis, uneasy, waited for questions on military matters, but they never came. The closest Sasaki got was to express confidence that Japan would win the war. He told Louis that he was a civilian employee of the Japanese Navy, which had made him head interrogator of all POWs in Japan. He said he bore a rank equal to that of admiral. Louis was taken outside. He was in a large compound with several one-story buildings surrounded by a high fence topped with barbed wire. There was something spooky about this place. Louis, like every man brought there, noticed it immediately. Gathered in drifts against the buildings were some 200 whisper-thin captive Allied servicemen. Every one of them had his eyes fixed on the ground. They were as silent as snow. Louis was led to a bench some distance from the other captives. He saw Phil far away, sitting alone. A couple of captives sat on other benches across the compound, hiding their hands from the guards' view and gesturing to each other in Morse code. Fists for dots and flat hands for dashes. Louis watched them until a captive approached. The man seemed to have permission to speak. He began to tell Louis about where he was. This wasn't a POW camp. It was a secret interrogation center called Ofuna, where high-value captured men were housed in solitary confinement, starved, tormented, and tortured to divulge military secrets. Because Ofuna was kept secret from the outside world, the Japanese operated with an absolutely free hand. The men in Ofuna, said the Japanese, weren't POWs. They were unarmed combatants, at war against Japan, and, as such, didn't have the rights that international law accorded POWs. In fact, they had no rights at all. If captives confessed their crimes against Japan, they'd be treated as well as regulations permit. Over the course of the war, some 1,000 Allied captives would be hauled into Ofuna, and many would be held there for years. The man told Louis the rules. He was forbidden to speak to anyone but the guards, to put his hands in his pockets, or to make eye contact with other captives. His eyes were to be directed downward at all times. He had to learn to count in Japanese, because every morning there was tenko, a roll call and inspection in which men had to count off. To use the benjo, latrine, he had to ask in broken Japanese, benjo kudasai, said while bowing. He wouldn't be given a cup, so if he was thirsty, he'd have to beg the guard to escort him to the washstand. There were rules about every detail of life, from the folding of blankets to the buttoning of clothes, each reinforcing isolation and total obedience. The slightest violation would bring a beating. The Japanese were abundantly clear about one thing. In this secret place, they could, and did, do anything they wanted to their captives, and no one would ever know. They stressed that they did not guarantee that captives would survive, Ofuna. They can kill you here, Louis was told. No one knows you're alive. After nightfall, Louis was taken into a barracks and led to a tiny cell. On the floor was a thin tatami, straw mat, which would be his bed, with three paper sheets. There was a small window, but it had no glass, so wind eddied through the room. The walls were flimsy, the floorboards gapped, the ceiling was tar paper. It was mid-September, and with winter approaching, Louis would be living in a building that was, in one captive's words, barely a windbreak. Louis curled up under the paper sheets. There were dozens of men in cells near him, but no one made a sound. Phil was in a cell far down the hall, and for the first time in months, Louis wasn't near him. In this warren of captive men, he was alone. Each day began at 6. A bell clanging, a shouting guard, captives running outside to tenko. Louis would fall into a line of haggard men. Guards stalked them, clubs or baseball bats in their hands and rifles with fixed bayonets over their shoulders, making menacing postures and yelling unintelligibly. The captives were hounded through a frenzied routine, counting off, bowing toward Emperor Hirohito, rushing to the washstand and Benjo, then rushing back to the assembly area 5 minutes later. Then it was back to the barracks, where guards rifled through the men's things in search of contraband, misfolded blankets, misaligned buttons, anything to justify a beating. Breakfast came from captives who handed out bowls of watery, fetid slop, which each man ate alone in his cell. Then men were paired off, given clots of wet rope, and forced to bend double, put the rope on the floor, and wash the 150-foot-long barracks aisle floor at a run, or sometimes waddling duck-style while the guards trotted behind them, swatting them. Then it was back outside, where the guards made the men run circles or perform calisthenics, often until they collapsed. When the exercise was over, the men had to sit outside, regardless of the weather. The only breaks in the silence were the screams coming from the interrogation room. Punctuating the passage of each day were beatings. Men were beaten for folding their arms, for sitting naked to help heal sores, for cleaning their teeth, for talking in their sleep. Most often, they were beaten for not understanding orders, which were almost always issued in Japanese. Dozens of men were lined up and clubbed in the knees for one man's alleged infraction. A favorite punishment was to force men to stand, sometimes for hours, in the Ofuna crouch, a painful and strenuous position in which men stood with knees bent halfway and arms overhead. Those who fell over or dropped their arms were clubbed and kicked. Captives who tried to assist victims were attacked themselves, usually far more violently, so victims were on their own. Any attempt to protect oneself, ducking, shielding the face, provoked greater violence. "My job," remembered captive Glenn McConnell, "was to keep my nose on my face and keep from being disassembled." The beatings, he wrote, were of such intensity that many of us wondered if we'd ever live to see the end of the war. At night, in the cell again, Louis awaited dinner, eaten alone in the dark. Then he just sat there. He wasn't permitted to speak, whistle, sing, tap, read, or look out his window. There was another inspection outside, another haranguing, and then the uneasy pause of night, the pacing of the guards before the dawn again brought shouting and running and the thud of clubs. At Ofuna, as at the scores of POW camps scattered throughout Japan and its conquests, the men used for guard duty were the dregs of the Japanese military. Many had washed out of regular soldierly life, too incompetent to perform basic duties. Quite a few were deranged. According to captives, there were two characteristics common to nearly all Ofuna guards. One was marked stupidity. The other was murderous sadism. In the Japanese military of that era, corporal punishment was routine practice. Iron must be beaten while it's hot. Soldiers must be beaten while they're fresh, was a saying among servicemen. "No strong soldiers," went another, "are made without beatings." For all Japanese soldiers, especially low-ranking ones, beating was inescapable, often a daily event. It is thus unsurprising that camp guards, occupying the lowest station in a military that applauded brutality, would vent their frustrations on the helpless men under their authority. Japanese historians call this phenomenon transfer of oppression. This tendency was powerfully reinforced by two opinions common in Japanese society in that era. One held that Japanese were racially and morally superior to non-Japanese, a pure people divinely destined to rule. Just as Allied soldiers, like the cultures they came from, often held virulently racist views of the Japanese, Japanese soldiers and civilians, intensely propagandized by their government, usually carried their own caustic prejudices about their enemies, seeing them as brutish, subhuman beasts, or fearsome Anglo-Saxon devils. This racism, and the hatred and fear it fomented, surely served as an accelerant for abuse of Allied prisoners. In Japan's militaristic society, all citizens, from earliest childhood, were relentlessly indoctrinated with the lesson that to be captured in war was intolerably shameful. The 1941 Japanese Military Field Code made clear what was expected of those facing capture. have regard for your family first. Rather than live and bear the shame of imprisonment, the soldier must die and avoid leaving a dishonorable name. As a result, in many hopeless battles, virtually every Japanese soldier fought to the death. For every Allied soldier killed, 4 were captured. For every 120 Japanese soldiers killed, 1 was captured. In some losing battles, Japanese soldiers committed suicide en masse to avoid capture. The few who were captured sometimes gave false names, believing that their families would rather think that their son had died. The depth of the conviction was demonstrated at Australia's Kaura camp in 1944, when hundreds of Japanese POWs flung themselves at camp machine guns and set their living quarters afire in a mass suicide attempt that became known as the Night of 1,000 Suicides. The contempt and revulsion that most Japanese felt for those who surrendered or were captured extended to Allied servicemen. This thinking created an atmosphere in which to abuse, enslave, and even murder a captive or POW was considered acceptable, even desirable. Some guards, intoxicated by absolute power and indoctrinated in racism and disgust for POWs, fell easily into sadism. But those less inclined toward their culture's prejudices may still have been vulnerable to the call of brutality. To be made responsible for imprisoning people is surely, to many guards, an unsettling experience, especially when they are tasked with depriving their prisoners of the most basic necessities. Perhaps some guards forced their prisoners to live in maximally dehumanizing conditions so that they could reassure themselves that they were merely giving loathsome beasts their due. Paradoxically, then, some of the worst abuses inflicted on captives and POWs may have arisen from the guards' discomfort with being abusive. Writing of his childhood in slavery, Frederick Douglass told of being acquired by a man whose wife was a tender-hearted woman who had never owned a slave. Her face was made of heavenly smiles and her voice of tranquil music, Douglass wrote. She lavished him with motherly love, even giving him reading lessons unheard of in slaveholding society. But after being ordered by her husband to treat the boy like the slave he was, she transformed into a vicious demon. She, like the Ofuna guards more than a century later, had succumbed to what Douglass called the fatal poison of irresponsible power. Of all the warped, pitiless men who persecuted captives at Ofuna, Sueharu Kitamura stood above all others. In civilian life, by different accounts, he was either a sake salesman or a movie scenario writer. In Ofuna, he was the medical officer. Fascinated by suffering, he forced sick and injured captives to come to him for treatment, then tortured and mutilated them while quizzing them on their pain. His mouth curved in a moist smile. Known as the butcher and the quack, Kitamura was Ofuna's most eager instigator of beatings. He was a massive man, built like a bison, and he punched like a heavyweight. No official in Ofuna was more hated or feared. Though under great pressure to conform to a culture of brutality, a few guards refused to participate in the violence. In one incident, a captive was clubbed so savagely that he was certain he was going to be killed. In the middle of the assault, the attacking guard was called away, and a guard known as Hirose was ordered to finish the beating. Out of sight of other guards, Hirose told the captives to cry out as if he were being struck, then pounded his club harmlessly against the floor. The two acted out their parts until it seemed enough beating had been done. The captive believed that Hirose may have saved his life. What Hirose did took nerve. Everywhere in Japan, demonstrating sympathy for captives or POWs was taboo. When a child living near the Sensuji POW camp expressed compassion for the prisoners, her comments became a national scandal. Camp personnel caught trying to improve conditions for POWs or even voicing sympathy for them were sometimes beaten by their superiors. The general opinion towards POWs at that time was very bad, wrote Yukichi Kano, a private at another camp who was beloved by POWs he tried to assist. There was always some risk of to be misunderstood by other Japanese by making humane interpretation of our duty. To resist against the wrong hostile feeling, prejudice, and lack of knowledge was not very easy for the lower-ranked soldier like me. At Ofuna, Merciful guards paid the price. One officer, upon learning that another guard had shown leniency to captives, assaulted the guard with a sword. During his nightly walk from his kitchen job to his cell, one captive would regularly see a guard who refused to beat prisoners being singled out for gang attacks from his fellow guards. At Ofuna, captives weren't just beaten, they were starved. The thrice daily meals usually consisted of a bowl of broth with a bit of vegetable, and a bowl or half bowl of rancid rice, sometimes mixed with barley. It contained virtually no protein and was grossly lacking in nutritive value and calories. It was camp policy to give diminished and/or spoiled rations to captives suspected of withholding information, and at times the entire camp's rations were cut to punish one captive's reticence. The food was infested with rat droppings, maggots, and so much sand and grit that Louis's teeth were soon pitted, chipped, and cracked. The men nicknamed the rations "Al Dumpo." The extremely low caloric intake and befouled food, coupled with the exertion of the forced exercise, put the men's lives in great danger. "We were dying," wrote captive Jean Balch, "on about 500 calories a day." Scurvy was common. Foodborne parasites and pathogens made diarrhea almost ubiquitous. Most feared was beriberi, a potentially deadly disease caused by a lack of thiamine. There were two forms of beriberi, and they could occur concurrently. Wet beriberi affected the heart and the circulatory system, causing marked edema, swelling of the extremities. If untreated, it was often fatal. Dry beriberi affected the nervous system, causing numbness, confusion, unsteady gait, and paralysis. When wet beriberi victims pressed on their swollen limbs, deep indentations would remain long after the pressure was removed, giving the men the unnerving impression that their bones were softening. In some cases, wet beriberi caused extreme swelling of the scrotum. Some men's testicles swelled to the size of bread loaves. In Ofuna's theater of cruelty, survival was an open question, and deaths were common. For Louis, Phil, and the other captives, the only hope lay in the Allies rescuing them. But this prospect also carried tremendous danger. In the fall of 1942, when the Americans attacked Japanese ships off Tarawa in the Gilbert Islands, the Japanese beheaded 22 POWs held on the island. A similar horror played out on Japanese-held Balale in the Shortland Islands, where British POWs were being used as slaves to build an airfield. According to a Japanese officer, in the spring of 1943, when it appeared that the Americans were soon to land on Balale, Japanese authorities issued a directive that in the event of an invasion, the POWs were to be killed. No landing occurred, but in response to an Allied bombing, the Japanese executed all of the POWs anyway, some 70 to 100 men. A few weeks after Louis arrived at Ofuna, an American carrier force began bombing and shelling Wake Atoll, where the Americans captured during the Japanese invasion were still being held as slaves. Mistakenly believing that an invasion was imminent, the Japanese commander had the prisoners blindfolded, bound, shot, and dumped in a hole. One man escaped. When he was caught 3 weeks later, the commander himself beheaded him. The only trace of the men was found years afterward, in the atoll lagoon on a hunk of coral. One of the POWs had scraped a message: 98 U.S. P.W., 5-10-43. These murders were the first applications of what would come to be known as the kill-all rule. Japanese policy held that camp commanders could not, under any circumstances, allow Allied forces to recapture POWs. If Allied advances made this a possibility, POWs were to be executed. If there is any fear that the POWs would be retaken due to the tide of battle turning against us, read a May 1944 order issued to every POW branch camp commander, decisive measures must be taken without returning a single POW. That August, the Japanese War Ministry would issue a clarification of this order, sending it to all POW camp commanders. At such time as the situation becomes urgent, and it be extremely important, the POWs will be concentrated and confined in their present location, and under heavy guard, the preparation for the final disposition will be made. Whether they are destroyed individually or in groups, or however it is done, with mass bombing, poisonous smoke, poisons, drowning, decapitation, or what, dispose of them as the situation dictates. In any case, it is the aim not to allow the escape of a single one, to annihilate them all, and not to leave any traces. As the Allies fought their way toward Japan, the captives in Ofuna and POWs everywhere else faced the very real threat that Allied successes would bring the kill-all policy to bear on them. While none of the captives knew of the incidents in which this order had already been followed, the guards at Ofuna enjoyed warning them about the policy. Like every other captive, Louis knew that most of the guards would be eager to carry it out. Chapter 20. Farting for Hirohito. At first, there was only silence and isolation. At night, all Louis could see were walls, stripes of ground through the gaps in the floorboards, and his own limbs, as slender as reeds. The guards would stomp down the aisles, occasionally dragging a man out to be beaten. There were men in cells around Louis, but no one spoke. Come daylight, Louis was suddenly among them, hustled outside and herded in crazy circles. With his eyes trained obediently on the ground and his mouth obediently closed, Louis was no less alone. The only break in the gloom came in the form of a smiling guard, who liked to saunter down the barracks aisle, pause before each cell, raise one leg, and vent a surly fart at the captive within. He never quite succeeded in farting his way down the entire cell block. In stolen glances, nods, and hushed words, Louis sorted out the constellations of Ofuna. His barracks was inhabited by new captives, mostly Americans, survivors of downed aircraft and sunken sea craft. Down the hall lived two emaciated American Navy officers, the ranking Allied servicemen. First in rank was Commander Arthur Marr, who had survived the sinking of his ship, the Houston, in Indonesia's Sunda Strait. He had swum to Java and fled into the mountains, only to be hunted down. Second in rank was 35-year-old Commander John Fitzgerald, who had fallen into Japanese hands after he'd scuttled his burning submarine, the Grenadier, which had been bombed. The Japanese had attempted, in vain, to torture information out of Fitzgerald, clubbing him, jamming penknives under his fingernails, tearing his fingernails off, and applying the water cure, tipping him backward, holding his mouth shut, and pouring water up his nose until he passed out. Both Marr and Fitzgerald spoke Japanese, and they served as the camp's only resident interpreters. All captives, regardless of nationality, deferred to them. During the forced exercise one day, Louis fell into step with William Harris, a 25-year-old Marine officer, the son of Marine General Field Harris. Tall and dignified, with a face cut in hard lines, Harris had been captured in the surrender of Corregidor in May 1942. With another American, he had escaped and embarked on an 8.5-hour swim across Manila Bay, kicking through a downpour in darkness as fish bit him. Dragging himself ashore on the Japanese-occupied Bataan Peninsula, he had begun a run for China, hiking through jungles and over mountains, navigating the coast in boats donated by sympathetic Filipinos, hitching rides on burros, and surviving in part by eating ants. He had joined a Filipino guerrilla band, but when he had heard of the American landing at Guadalcanal, the Marine in him had called. Making a dash by boat toward Australia in hopes of rejoining his unit, he had gotten as far as the Indonesian island of Morotai before his journey ended. Civilians had turned him in to the Japanese, who had discovered that he was a general's son, and sent him to Ofuna. Even here, he was itching to escape. Each day, Louis and Harris hung together, laboring through forced exercise, bearing blows from the guards, and whispering. The curious thing about Harris was that while he was certainly a tall man, 6'2" or 6'3", according to his daughter, virtually everyone, including Louis, would remember him as a giant, by one account 6'8", by another 6'10". Figuratively, though, Harris was indeed a giant. He was probably a genius. Impeccably educated, conversant in several languages, including Japanese, he had a perfect photographic memory. With a single glance, he could memorize a huge volume of information and retain it for years. In Ofuna, this attribute would be a blessing and a terrible curse. Jimmy Sasaki made frequent visits to Ofuna, and he liked to call Louis to his office. Among ragged captives and guards in drab uniforms, Sasaki was a spectacle, dressing like a movie star and wearing his hair slicked back and parted down the middle, like Howard Hughes. The captives dubbed him Handsome Harry. Louis expected interrogation, but it never came. Sasaki only wanted to reminisce about USC and boast of Japan's coming victory. He knew that Louis had lied in his interrogation on Kwajalein, but he didn't pursue the truth. Louis couldn't understand it. Every other captive was grilled, at least at first, but no effort was made to interrogate him. He suspected that Sasaki was using his influence to protect him. Ofuna had one other notable resident. Gaga was a duck who bobbed around in a fire trough, paddling with a broken leg that a captive had fitted with a little splint. The duck trailed the captives around like a puppy, limping in and out of the kitchen, where the workers apparently fed him. Every morning at Tenko, Gaga peg-legged to the parade ground and stood with the men, and one captive would later swear that when the men bowed toward the emperor, Gaga bowed in imitation. In so dark a place, this cheerful bird became especially beloved. For the captives, wrote Ofuna survivor Pappy Boyington, Gaga became a creature on which to rest their tortured brains a moment while they were praying and worrying if anyone would ever free them. Louis rarely crossed paths with Phil, who was housed far down the hall. The pilot seemed to be handling Ofuna well enough, but he remained shrunken and frail, a hollow distance in his eyes. During forced exercise, he wasn't strong enough to run, so he and a few others were separated and harangued through calisthenics. Once, when Louis and Phil shuffled up next to each other on the parade ground, Phil finally spoke of the crash. Filled with anguish, he said that he felt responsible for the deaths of all those men. Louis reassured him that the crash hadn't been his fault, but Phil was unswayed. "I'll never fly again," he said. In time, Louis discovered that both the forced silence of Ofuna and the bowing submission of its captives were illusions. Beneath the hush was a humming underground of defiance. It began with sidelong whispers. The guards couldn't be everywhere, and as soon as an area was left unattended, the captives became absorbed in stealthy muttering. Men scribbled notes on slips of toilet paper and hid them for each other in the benjo. Once, when given permission to speak aloud so he could translate orders, Commander Marr advised another captive on stealing techniques right in front of the oblivious guards. The boldest captives would walk up to the guards, look straight at them, and speak in English, using a querying tone. The confused guards thought they were being asked questions, when in fact the men were speaking to each other. When words couldn't be used, Morse code could. At night, in the small intervals when the guards left the building, the whole barracks would start tapping. Outside, men would whisper in code, using tit for dot and da for dash, words that could be spoken without moving the lips. Louis used his hands for code, obscuring them from the guards. Most of the discussions were trivial. Louis would be remembered for descriptions of his mother's cooking. But the content didn't matter. The triumph was in the subversion. Louis soon learned a critical rule of conversation. Never use a guard's real name. Guards who discovered that they were being discussed often delivered savage beatings, so the men invented nicknames for them. The sluggish, quiet camp commander was called the Mummy. Guard nicknames included Turd Bird, Flange Face, the Weasel, Liver Lip, Fatty, and Termite. A particularly repugnant guard was known as Shithead. The defiance took on a life of its own. Men would smile and address the guards in friendly tones, cooing out insults filthy enough to curl a man's hair. One captive convinced a particularly dim-witted guard that a sundial would work at night if he used a match. A fragrant favorite involved saving up intestinal gas, explosively voluminous thanks to chronic dysentery, prior to Tenko. When the men were ordered to bow toward the emperor, the captives would pitch forward in concert and let thunderclaps fly for Hirohito. Louis had another, private act of rebellion. A fellow captive, a bookbinder in civilian life, gave him a tiny book that he'd made in camp with rice paste, flattened into pages and sewn together. Louis either found or stole a pencil and began keeping a diary. In it, he recorded what had happened since his crash, then continued with life in the camp. On the book's central pages, in bold print, He wrote hometown contact information for other captives, making it seem to be an innocuous address book. He wrote his diary entries in faint script upside down in the back of the book